Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Patton Oswalt is an actor and comedian known for his many film and TV roles, including the voice of Remy, the culinary rat in Disney Pixar's 2007 Ratatouille, Spencer, the paranoid friend in CBS's The King of Queens, and Penn Ebner, the leader of a citizen crime sleuth club in Hulu's season 4 of Veronica Mars. But most importantly, as Oswalt himself will tell you, he's father to 11-year-old Alice, his daughter with his late wife, author and true crime blogger Michelle McNamara. Since Michelle's sudden death 4 years ago, Oswalt has spoken eloquently and hilariously about grief, mourning, and learning to raise Alice without her mother. He also pushed through it all to publish McNamara's unfinished book, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, One Woman's Obsessive Search for the Golden State Killer. And he's now executive producer of the forthcoming 6-part docuseries of the same name, premiering on HBO this Sunday, June 28th. And Patton Oswalt joins us now to talk about that, to talk about parenting and about humor in a pandemic. He's with us from Los Angeles. Welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
It's so great to talk with you. Well, first of all, how do you feel about this HBO docuseries, seeing the light of day here?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. I mean, I'm very, very happy that the fuller, even deeper story, more up-to-date story is getting told, the one that happily ends with Joseph DeAngelo being arrested for his crimes. And I'm extremely happy that the series was directed by Liz Garbus, who's an incredible documentarian and who made I think a masterpiece. You know, the mixed bag for me is that as exec producer, you know, I have to watch the rough cuts, and there are moments, reliving moments in my life that were really, really psychically and emotionally and spiritually difficult. So there were, you know, I had to take breaks in between some of these, and it was, you know, I'm certainly not going to let Alice watch this now. She can watch it when she's older, but yeah. You know, Liz is really, really good at getting into the meat of things, not just with what I went through losing Michelle, which is a very small part of it, but even deeper, what the survivors, the victims' families, the investigators went through, the years of just rage and hopelessness, basically. And so there's an amazing redemptive arc at the end of all of it that. It's Liz Garbus and her filmmaking genius.
Well, I absolutely hear you about that redemptive arc passing through the lives of the victims of the Golden State Killer and their families as well. And I think that's an important point to make. But since I've got you here on the other end of the microphone, I do want to talk a little bit about, you know, more about what this process was like for you, because as you said, you had to go back to those incredibly painful moments losing Michelle. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, the process for me was very similar to the process of writing the book, in that there was a huge ask on my end of when I needed to get the book done. I didn't finish the book. It was Billy Jensen and Paul Haynes and her agent and publisher. I handed all the materials to them and said, this has got to be done. I don't know how to do it. You know, this is so beyond my, especially with how wrecked and wounded and weak I am right now. And they really picked that up. And then with the documentary, which, you know, goes deeper, especially visually and audibly, I kind of reached out to her, all of her friends, all of her family, went back through all of my photographs and films and little videos on my laptop and on my phone of her, and I gave both of her laptops and her phone. I called a computer guy that I know to get them unlocked, gave all that material to the filmmaker. So you see her emails and her texts and everything. So it was initially that was really hard. And then there was that handing off and being kind of like, I've put this in someone else's hands because I can't actually sift through it piece by piece myself because it'll be too devastating. But again, I'm gonna bring up her name a lot in this. But Liz Garbus, if you watch her other stuff, the Nina Simone documentary, the New York Times documentary, you know that you feel confident putting material in her hands if you watch her other films.
Oh yeah. Well, let's listen to a little bit from the first episode, okay, if we can.
Sure.
This is episode one, again, premiering on Sunday, June 28th on HBO of I'll Be Gone in the Dark. And here's a scene where, Patton, you're signing copies of the book, of mm-hmm. Michelle's book that you helped see through to its completion. You're signing copies and reflecting on what that process was like of having to do that without her.
I was in the basement struggling to get this afterword done because it was hard going, because I was also rereading the book. And there were those moments when I would want to just, like, run upstairs and go tell her something because it felt like I was listening to her, and then I'm like, oh, no, she's not, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was just, it was a very dark week.
That's from the first episode of I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Do you want to talk about that a little bit more?
Well, I mean, there are moments when you read the book, and especially when you watch the documentary, when the actress Amy Ryan, amazing actress Amy Ryan, from Gone Baby Gone and The Office and The Wire, reads Michelle's texts and emails and letters and other pieces of writing, and there is that feeling of, oh wait, isn't she here? Like why isn't she here for the, like, when you see, because so much of her voice and her soul came through in her writing. Mm-hmm. So when you read her writing, it feels like you want to turn to your right and tell her something. Like, she's come back because of the way that she wrote. She was very, very personal and present in how she wrote and what she wrote about. So that's what I say. It's a very dark week in that it really exacerbated her. The paradox was, it really, really amplified her absence by having her feel so present in, mm-hmm. in reading all that stuff and listening to all that stuff. Does that make sense?
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It absolutely does. And I think that's one of the things that is frequently experienced when people are remembering moments with with loved ones. It's like they're right back there. Present in the room. Since you mentioned it, we do have a clip of Amy Ryan reading some of Michelle's writing. And here is a bit where Amy's reading Michelle's words about what she thought of the early stages of your relationship, Patton. So again, this is actor Amy Ryan reading Michelle McNamara's words.
We loved many of the same things, like Creature from the Black Lagoon, Tales of the Grim and Offbeat, and good food. I didn't like the way his comedian friends, including him, seemed to tell jokes but never listen. He thought I was thin-skinned. For a while, it seemed it might not work. But one night, he was saying goodbye to me, and he won me over with an adorable Edward G. Robinson impression.
You know what? Obviously, I never knew Michelle in person at all. But even just those words, what an amazing woman.
I mean, she was such an original personality and so her own person, and just didn't take crap from anyone, but then would also surprise herself by what would delight her. And she didn't judge what delighted her. So, like, she was such an elevated person in comparison to pretty much anyone else I had met up to that point in my life. So it was kind of, you know, it really bowled me over, took me off my feet for a long time.
I love her direct honesty there when she says, when she writes, I didn't like the way his comedian friends, including him, seemed to tell jokes but never listen.
Well, that, unfortunately, in that one sentence, she absolutely nailed the species of comedian. If you've ever hung with comedians, we're all waiting for our line. When do I jump in? We're all riffing. It's not a conversation. It's a weird jousting match And yeah, she saw that very early on.
I feel like that kind of honest and loving directness we need more of in this world.
Yes. Oh God, yeah. Well, so, luckily, you know, in a weird way, I found that again. I never thought I'd find that again, and I did with Meredith, my wife now, Meredith Salinger, who is in that exact same way of like, I'm just going to tell you exactly what I'm feeling right now. What is the point of pulling a punch? It's just going to cause hassle down the road. So it's amazing when you meet someone like that.
So I wanted to talk about the docuseries and Michelle, not in order to sort of just drag out all these poignant and maybe even sometimes painful moments in remembering her, but also to, you know, just I wanted to reflect for a second with you that honestly, as a nation, because of this pandemic, there are more than 120,000 people who have died so far, meaning, you know, millions possibly of people who know someone, who've lost someone they love.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just hoping, could we learn, do you have anything from your experience of going through this in such a public way also that you could share with people?
You know, I remember a few days after Michelle died, this was it was late at night. Alice couldn't sleep. She had come into bed. You know, she was like, I can't sleep. You know, she was having nightmares. Of course, I was having nightmares. We could not. It was like 3 a.m. and we're just talking. And, you know, and Alice said, when your mom dies, you're the best memory of her. Mm. Everything that you do is a memory of her. And I remember that moment. I remember I wrote it down because I feel like when we lose people that we love, or when we see that even maybe someone that we weren't that close to, but they're gone, it doesn't ultimately do them. They would not want their legacy to be someone's life was ruined because of their absence. For them, be a living tribute to them.
Yeah. Well, we're talking this hour with Patton Oswalt about the new HBO docuseries that's coming out on Sunday. We'll come back and talk more about parenting and humor in a pandemic as well. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Patton Oswalt, the actor and comedian. His latest stand-up special is called I Love Everything. It's streaming now on Netflix. He's also executive producer of I'll Be Gone in the Dark. It's a 6-part docuseries premiering this Sunday on HBO based on the book of the same name that explores his late wife Michelle McNamara's investigation into the Golden State Killer. Again, that's premiering on HBO on Sunday. Now, Patton, before the break, you talked about, we started talking about your raising your daughter after Michelle passed away. But I want to just play a little bit of a performance, a stand-up performance that you gave, which I think Alice actually plays like the key role here. Okay, so
this
is from March. Okay, you performed and tweeted pandemic stand-up, if we can call it that, from your front yard. Okay,
yes.
So there were like barely any audience members. Alice is one of them. So let's hear a little moment from that.
All right, folks, thanks for staying in tonight. I hope you guys are isolating and securing in place. Wow, this COVID-19, I tell you. You know, I don't know, I didn't see COVID 1 through 18, so I don't really know what this is all about. But hey, you know, great time to catch up on your streaming stuff. Oh, hey, how you doing there? How you doing today?
You suck.
All right, let's...
I'm sorry, Pat. I'm so sorry. So, she's a tough crowd.
She's a really tough crowd. That was, we were, I remember that was the the day, it was 2 days after the lockdown was announced, and we had gone to visit a friend to make sure they were doing okay. And we just sort of came up, we were doing that one of those social distance visits, like, are you okay? You know, and then... it was kind of spontaneous. So I was like, I should just film me doing stand up out on this lawn. And then Meredith's like, well, let's do it. Like, she did the cinematography where she's like, let's start on you. And then I'll circle around and I'll reveal how empty everything is. And then we recruited Alice to be. I just love the idea of because comedians are addicted to we're addicted to what we do. So there were going to be, you know, that's the first thing I envisioned was comedians were going to go out in their front lawn and just start yammering because they're just so desperate for any kind of audience. But I was also like, no matter where we go, there will be a heckler. And of course, Alice was perfect as this little girl wanting to talk, who takes time to stop and let me know how awful I am, which it's weird. A lot of my comedian friends were laughing to me about how the most comforting part of that video for me was the heckler. Like, yes, still there it is. That's the club. Oh,
so
still happening.
Everything hasn't changed. Not everything.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, good. We're gonna make it. There's still people telling me I suck. Okay, great. Thank God.
So how is Alice doing? She's 11 now.
I mean, Alice is doing okay. I mean, I think for a lot of kids, what bothers me is, you know, I'm still very, very. I think like a lot of creative people, one of the ways that you keep your creativity is you kind of don't lose your child's perspective on things. You remember very strongly what it was like to be a kid and what a kid's perspective on life looked like when, you know, summers were endless and it was, you know, and so to see this generation of kids getting a summer taken away from them, I just wonder if there's going to be psychic damage down the road, if that's going to shape how this generation sees and does things. I hope that it shapes it. They find a way to shape it in a good way. But that is something that weighs very, very heavily on my mind. Like, I'm doing what I can whenever I can to like give her a summer. I don't really know. I haven't figured out quite how to do that yet because, you know, I don't want to get on an airplane anywhere. I don't want to go to any kind of crowded public space, but, you know, go out bike riding with masks. Try to do treasure hunts in the house, or I don't know. I'm just trying to. You want to give them those loose summer days because I think that's a part of growing up is to have just goof around time as a kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
and I mean, I can understand how this would be even more. This is on every parent or parents' minds. And in addition, yeah. I mean, in your case, and specifically, Alice has already been through so much.
Yeah.
Can you just, I'm pausing here, Patton, because I'm a mom too. And sometimes, I mean, parents do these weird sort of mental gymnastics where every once in a while, maybe, well, I'll just speak for myself here. I think, God, what would I do if this sort of very carefully crafted family unit that we have, that if a key part of that like just was gone, like if the keystone got pulled out, how would I hold this bridge up?
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's like a self-torturing mental preparation exercise. I don't know what it is, but just sometimes I do that. And yet you had to live through that. So, I mean, that first year after Michelle died, like... How did you hold yourself together?
I held myself together. A lot of times I didn't. I'll flat out say there were days when I could not hold it together, where I remember very specifically that Alice missed a day of school because I could not sleep. And then when I did go to sleep, I didn't wake up till noon, and I hadn't woken her up and hadn't gotten, I'm like, oh, she's not going to school today, because I could not get it together. But then those days when you fall apart so profoundly, that's when you, okay, you've got to function on a basic level here. You reach out to people. You are living with the, and even though, yeah, there were, you know, just like any married couple, like anyone, when you meet someone that further completes you and makes you a better person than you are, you do have those dark thoughts of, what if I lost this person? How would I function? But in your mind, you're only imagining a hypothetical. The actual having to live through it is so, you're absolutely not prepared on any way. It's a moment to moment terror. So, if it's any comfort, this is so not going to be comforting. You don't get through it. You're put through it.
Uh-huh.
Like, there are days where it gets so bad that it's almost like you have you get that freedom from choice, where you're like, well, I'm just going to get put through this. Like, in a way, I have the freedom of powerlessness here. I just have to be put through this.
Yeah.
And that's not a comforting thing to say, but it's true. It really is. Like, I'm just going to exist day to day. And there are days when, you know, there was a lot of, and a lot of the deeper grief I hid from Alice, because my reasoning was, she's already going through a nightmare. She doesn't need to see her dad crying. She doesn't need to see her dad, you know, just scrolling through pictures or freak, like having panic attacks. She just doesn't need that. So I did everything I could to hide that from her.
No,
at least give her a rock.
You know? I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that, because that's one of your takeaways from here that you've shared before, and I totally get it, right? Because like you said, you want to be the remaining rock for your child when she's experienced such a profound and wrenching loss. But at the same time, like, it's a balancing act, right? Because she was young, so I get it. Maybe if she were older, it'd be different. But, you know, like, there's also the affirmation of the grief that she's feeling, that she might see in you as you were struggling too. You know what I mean?
Right, exactly. I mean, I did struggle with that. How much do I show her? I mean, I think there were ways without it being overt that I showed her. Again, the day that Daddy wakes up at noon and is just can't even think straight, that you know, I think that was the, oh, okay, Daddy's going through something too.
Mm.
But I don't know what it was. I was trying not to. I mean, the day that I told her, the day after Michelle passed and I had to sit Alice down and tell her, I burst into tears trying to talk to her because I just couldn't, you know.
Yeah.
But after that, I'm like, I don't want to add to this trauma. You know, this kid's had, she's a little kid. She's had enough trauma now. Why am I, you know, I can't add to it.
Yeah. Well, we've got actually a listener on Facebook, Jacob Evans, who says, Patton Oswalt is a delight. He'd be curious. Jacob's curious to hear what keeps you going when things are rough.
Well, you know, one way to keep yourself going when things are rough, if you are struggling with depression, is to just be very open about, I need some help. Like, I do weekly talk therapy. I'm on antidepressants. There's no shame in that. Those things help, you know, because mankind developed those. We clearly invented those for a reason. Why would you not take advantage of that? Other ways I think to keep going is one thing that really helped me was, well, how can I help someone else out? There's nothing that makes you feel more present and alive as a person than when you're lifting someone else up, or if you're giving away some of your power. That it is such an affirmation of, oh, I'm alive and I exist and I have an effect on things. So look around maybe for someone else to help, even if it's not direct. Like, can I, you know, volunteer somewhere? Can I contribute, donate somewhere? Whatever it is, you know, just check in on someone that you think might need help.
Mm.
It sounds weird, but it really, really helps.
Did you learn anything, or what did you learn about yourself as a father having to do this?
I learned as a father that you can royally screw up a lot of things and still be a good parent. There are times when you're like, oh God, she doesn't have any clean socks. Oh man, I didn't get this form signed for school. And you go and you very open about, I didn't sign this thing. I'm sorry, I'm late. Can I please get this thing done? Or, oh God, I forgot to make her lunch. I got to drive back to school. It's just, you know, like when you screw up, absorb the blow, roll with it, and fix it.
Yeah, I suppose,
you know, you're gonna screw up as a parent. It's gonna happen.
Tell me about
You're gonna screw up as when both parents are there. I'm sure you've had that where you guys are like, oh, did we just totally forget to do this? Like, it's gonna happen.
Every day.
Yeah.
every single day.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
I had it happen to me last night where we had a little incident in my household and I did not respond with my best maternal self. Let's put it that way.
I know. Every parent is like, I know exactly what you're talking about right now.
And afterwards, yeah. after I decided to finally get around to taking some deep breaths, I was like, okay, so that did not go as I would have wanted it to.
I'm gonna mess that up. But again, think of how when we were growing up, the well-intentioned but really dumb things our parents did in the 70s and 80s. You get through it. Everyone's just doing the best they can with what they have.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so let's hear a little bit more about how parenting, or what it's been like for you, because there's also the issue now as of earlier this year about homeschooling. So in a tweet from March, you shared some of your homeschooling methods. And here's a this is Alice. We'll hear Alice here. She was working on a report about Cleveland, Ohio, and you decided to teach her about some of the city's connections to great comic book legends, including Harvey P. Carr. So here it is.
In fact, in 2003, they did a movie of American Splendor. Actually, it came down to me and another comedian named Judah Friedlander for the part of Toby Radloff, who's Harvey's best friend. They went with Judah, you know, and Judah was good. Judah was good, you know, but he looked just like him. So I guess that's as far as their imagination went. Now, I thought I brought something different to it, but no, let's just make it look exactly like it does in the comic book. Okay? The whole
Please,
thing.
Get a vaccine.
Judah didn't even read the comic. I mean, I was a fan of that thing.
Patton, can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Well, that's also me kind of making fun of myself when, and Meredith points this out all the time, when I'll just start going off on these weird kind of riffs about pop culture and movies where and she's like, you're talking to your daughter doesn't care about this. When she'll watch some movie or read some graphic novel or novel, I'm like, well, you know, interestingly enough, there's three different, I'll just start yammering about all this useless knowledge that's in my brain. And Meredith has to kind of go, no one knows what you're talking about right now. What are you doing? So, you know, we thought it'd be funny to make a video that way of my horrible parenting teaching techniques. It'll be great if she ever takes a college course on trivia. Then that's my time to shine.
Well, this happens. This is one of the things about live radio. I wanted to go back. There's something I should have asked you a little earlier, and I didn't.
Oh.
So I'm just going to circle back.
Go ahead.
About that first year. After Michelle died, because you know, did you turn to comedy at all during that time to help you and Alice, or was it just a no-go zone?
For me, it was just being present with her and just trying to like read to her and things like that. As far as comedy was concerned, I didn't do comedy for, I think like, I didn't even think of doing stand-up for like 4 or 5 months. And then it just got to like, I don't know what else to do. And I remember I went and did an open mic thinking, I'm just going to do this so that it'll be so horrible that I'll remind myself that I shouldn't be doing comedy. But it was such a release for me to go up and talk. And again, it was like this resurging of the life force. So I kept going. And then as far as watching comedy, you know what I really needed after Michelle passed and I was in all my grief, I needed absolute absurdity. And I turned to comedy like a lot. There was a lot of Tim and Eric, a lot of Eric Andre, just nonsensical. I mean, abstract weirdness. That's what I wanted. Because nothing made sense to me, it was actually comforting to see people embracing the nonsensical, especially. And I remember I kept listening to a lot of early Steve Martin albums. Let's Get Small, Comedy's Not Pretty, because it was just pure absurdity.
Yeah.
And it was so comforting to me.
That makes total sense to me because I feel like when reality has ventured into the absurd, like the only thing to meet it with is absurdity. I've felt that in this pandemic, actually.
Oh, I mean, again, that's why I think a lot of the best comedy that's coming out of this pandemic is the absolute absurd. I mean, although in a weird way, I'm sure you've talked about this too. You know, this new superstar Sarah Cooper, who lip syncs the Trump stuff. What's so brilliant about her is that her joke is she's almost playing someone who's trying to make Trump look better, which only like highlights the absurdity of what he's saying. Like if she was there pulling faces and being goofy, like look at this dummy, you would go, okay, you're lip syncing it. But the fact that she's almost, it looks like she's playing someone who's on Trump's media team. Like, okay, he said something really dumb today. Let's have you, you're very intelligent and put together. Let's have you do it. And it makes it look 10 times worse. It's so brilliant.
Well, we are talking this hour with Patton Oswalt, the actor and comedian. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to be asking, what would American democracy look like reimagined for the 21st century? We're going to be talking to some scholars who have actually done that mental exercise. And so we want to know, what do you think? What is the state of American democracy? What bold ideas would you propose to improve the system of governance and the democratic institutions of the United States for the 21st century? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683 with your questions and ideas about revamping American democracy. That's for the show tomorrow. Today, we are talking with Patton Oswalt. He's the actor and comedian known for his many film and TV roles, including the voice of Remy in Disney Pixar's Ratatouille. By the way, we just rewatched that in my family a couple of weeks ago, Patton, and the movie holds up as beautifully today as it did back in 2007.
Thank you.
He's also been on ABC's The Goldbergs, on CBS's The King of Queens, on Veronica Mars. He's author of Zombie Spaceship Wasteland, a book by Patton Oswalt. And he's executive producer of I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is the 6-part HBO docuseries based on the book of the same name that explores his late wife Michelle McNamara's investigation into the Golden State Killer. And that, again, premieres this Sunday on HBO. I wanted to get all of that in, Patton, because it's your long and rich career here is one of the reasons why we're getting all of this social media love for you here. Jamie Barraclough? Sorry, Jamie, if I said your name wrong, but Jamie says, the patron saint of nerds. I will watch anything with this guy in it. Everything he's done has been fantastic.
Jamie, good Lord. Thank you. Wow. I'll take it. I'll totally take it.
And Jin says, totally enjoying the discussion about death and comedy. Thank you for this interview. And
my God, what a weird sentence. Totally enjoying the discussion about death and comedy.
I think it shows the complexity of thought and emotion amongst our listeners here. Okay, and then how about this one? Socially distancing Stephanie C. says, thank you, Patton, for sharing Alice's words. My mom died about a week ago, and I found this so very comforting. I think that she's referencing Alice's words about being the living memory of people that you lost. So people are listening, Patton. I also wanted to say that earlier in the show when we were playing some of the clips of you and actually featuring Alice, and I laughed out loud. I have to say, I just like feeling that belly laugh. It was kind of like a surprise. I was like, oh, that's what this feels like. I haven't had this feeling in a long time. I do feel like all of us have had this sort of collective holding of our breaths like suspended animation for many months now. And even something as simple as the release of laughter actually is coming as a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, we've been whistling past the graveyard for so long. And I know that's a terrible analogy to use right now. But, you know, with all this death there, I mean, the dead would want us to laugh. You know, it's the tyrants who don't like the sound of laughter. So, you know, to go, we're going to live and we're going to fix this. A lot of times that starts with laughter, not to sound dismissive of any of the horror that's going on around us, but it is, and it's such a cliche to say, but it's a release valve. If you don't have that, I think people go insane.
Yeah. That's what makes it so subversive, actually, also. one of the things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The people in power are not crazy about comedy and laughter.
Mm.
Yeah.
But earlier in the show, you were talking about how the best you could do so far because of the pandemic regarding doing stand-up was standing outside in your front yard.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, how has not being able to have that direct connection with audiences during the pandemic affected the comedians?
I can't speak for other comedians. For me, it's been pretty bad. I mean, I write ideas down in notebooks, but I don't flesh them out until I'm in front of a crowd. And I also don't flesh them out to where I like them to be unless I'm hanging out with other comedians and we all do shows together. And then afterward, we're like, oh, hey, you know, you could add to the end. Like, God, this is so weird. I called a friend yesterday, this brilliant comedian named Todd Glass. And one of the last shows I did before the pandemic, he was a guest on it. And I called him to tag a joke that he had done that I saw him do, I think 5 or 6 months ago, just so that I could go, oh, I thought of a little thing to add to your joke. I hope you don't mind me. He's like, no. Like, you could tell that he had missed that too. Like, just comedians trading ideas back and forth. It was like I needed a fix. So I called him up just to give him a tag for his joke. It was just insane. Like, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is my Gen X thinking. There are Gen Z people that can see a way around it. I don't see a way that comedy works over Zoom or comedy works over, I mean, not stand-up comedy. I mean, podcasts are still, there's amazing podcasts out there, you know, Comedy Bang Bang and anything that Andy Daly does, anything that Lauren Lapkus does. They've made that work. But for me, I have to be in front of a crowd.
Yeah.
I have to be.
Well, you talked about in another interview that not having access to or not being able to perform at like comedy clubs, et cetera, that you were seeing a collapse there akin to the collapse of the comedy clubs of the late 80s. Do I have that right?
Yeah, there was a boom. There was a huge boom in the 80s and then it was a collapse. But that collapse led to stuff like people doing their own stuff and alt comedy and rooms like the Largo and, you know, rooms like the M Bar and the stuff in New York, like Fez and the Time Cafe. So there was something good came out of that collapse. There's a collapse now. I think it's more economic. You know, that collapse came from, it was a glut of mediocrity and people got sick of it. So then the alt stuff had to come start rising. Right now, this is just, you know, the clubs actually had gotten really amazing because they got taken over by that younger generation. They were booking way more interesting acts. So now the clubs themselves are just simply struggling because there's not bodies in them, you know, buying things. So we will see what comes. Hopefully something good will come out of this. Right now, I'm aware enough to admit that I don't see what it could be. And I hope someone can prove me wrong. Please, somebody show me what I'm missing because I need it.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, even as viewers watching comedians try to do the best work they can on screens without even knowing that there's the energy of the live audience there, even for television comedians, it's a strange experience as a viewer. Yeah. Right, I feel like it's all like we're trying to form a brand new, a different kind of relationship between audience and the comedians.
Well, because the audience was part of the equation, they were part of the reaction. Because how the audience reacts or doesn't react changes the flow of the comedy. So when people are just putting their stuff out into, I'm looking at a tiny little, you know, lens on a laptop. I'm not shifting anything that I'm doing, and there's something missing there. Mm-hmm. There's alchemy that's missing.
Yeah. You know, you said that maybe people younger and smarter than you will figure it out on how
they always do. I mean, they always do.
But I was going to say that you've got it figured out pretty well on Twitter.
I mean, somewhat. I mean, Twitter is its own form, I guess, of writing and stand up and comedy, and some people have really, really mastered it. I would say I'm pretty good at it. There's other people, you know, in my opinion, people like Jess Dweck and Michael Drucker and people like that that are truly amazing with the form, with the writing and how they do things. But I adapted pretty well because I was always very writerly anyway, I guess. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it can. But Twitter is its own beast. It's its own. Someone just this morning, you know, speaking of Sarah Cooper, every time she puts out a new video, I retweet it because it's the best thing out there. And after watching it, I think Ben Stiller today said, "I watched this three times before realizing I'd watched it three times," when he retweeted it.
Yeah.
And I just I retweeted yesterday and just wrote "Queen" over it because a lot of times I've learned on Twitter when you retweet something, it actually gets it more views if you add a little comment on the top, like, "Oh my God, this is amazing." Or, you know, you quote tweet it. And some woman, I don't know her name, but she was like, are men just unable to retweet something without adding a comment to it? Like, "Thank you, patriarchy." I'm like, I'm just trying to, what in the hell? Like, there's ways you can just not, like, "Oh my God, I'm trying to say how brilliant I think this is. I don't need you telling me how brilliant. What the hell is wrong with you?"
Like,
so there's always those people that are just angry about. And speaking, you know, Mike Drucker tweeted, I think this was a few months ago. He's like, "Twitter is the kind of place where if you could tweet like, 'I like horses,' and your responses will be, 'What about zebras? What about cows? Your silence on hippos is very telling.' Like, oh my God, I can't. The hell is wrong with you?"
Well, your version of the patriarchy has 4.6 million followers.
And I'm trying to amplify other voices, and people are like, "Hey, no, thank you." Wait, what?
Oh man. But is your Twitter, who you are on Twitter, is that very similar to your onstage comedy work? Because there's obviously a lot of politics on your Twitter as well.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't do that much politics in my stand-up, but Twitter is more about reacting to what's going on. And there is so much absurdity that I think a lot of the times the reason that there's so much quote-unquote politics on my Twitter is I'm almost doing a sanity check with the rest of the world. Like, hey, you guys are all seeing this too, right? Like, I'm not going insane right now. I just want to check in and make sure that I just saw what I saw, because we're also living in a reality where there are just blatant videos and images of things that are happening and audio of things that are being said. And then immediately people are like, "That's not what you heard. That's not what you saw." And you got to go, no, I'm actually looking at this. Like, this is this now this feels like a Stanley Milgram experiment that I'm being put through. So I need to check in and have someone tell me, yes, you also saw that.
Wow. You're one of the first guests in a while that's gotten a Milgram reference in there.
Hey, look, it's NPR. I know the audience, right? You got to throw a Milgram in there. You got to throw a Shirley Jackson in there, and you got to throw in a Garrett Kaiser. Boom, you're good. All right.
Yeah. Well, it's not a good NPR conversation unless we talk about people being told to, like, how much voltage would you shock a person on the other side of a screen with? I don't know what kind of accolade that is for NPR. But
yeah, exactly. Can't have NPR without a Milgram reference.
Oh my God. Look, listen, people are really responding to hearing you. We've got Cat View, who says, so talented, caring, and still humble. Thanks for all the laughs. Jessica Gallagher-Pyle says, thank you for this. Patton Oswalt is a perfect disarming role model for widowers and widows everywhere. It's his openness about grief that brought me, a widow, to his comedy. It's his honesty that keeps me watching and listening. He's a gem. And let's see here. Oh, even more. Oh, how about this? Sam Ewing says, does he think he knows who the Zodiac Killer is? The Zodiac Killer in this case. If he wants to answer just yes or no, that's perfectly fine.
No, I do not know that. Unfortunately, that's not my wheelhouse. Although Michelle reread Robert Graysmith's book over and over again. That was one of her abiding obsessions was, who's the Zodiac and who's D.B. Cooper? She's like, I'm going to find out who D.B. Cooper is. So that was also she was into crime. She knew all this stuff. She was the JonBenet case. She was on all those message boards. She knew all the slang. So, you know, all that that whole world, she knew that way better than I did.
Mm. So I want to play one more clip here.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. The Zodiac Killer, yeah, that's Ted Cruz.
Stop. Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz. Sorry.
Putting my serious journalist hat back on,
yes,
here.
Yes, please.
I want to play one more clip here, because this is actually a staff favorite. This is from NBC's Parks and Recreation, where
God.
Were Garth Blunden, and you were determined to prevent Leslie Knope, played by Amy Poehler, of course, from amending a town charter, and you launched into a filibuster about Star Wars and other things. So let's just quickly listen.
Hand down from the twin sons of Tatooine, we are now close on the mouth of the Sarlacc pit. After a beat, the gloved Mandalorian armor gauntlet of Boba Fett grabs onto the sand outside the Sarlacc pit, and the feared bounty hunter pulls himself from the maw of the sand beast.
Okay, this is exactly...
And we realize that he survived his fall during the battle at Jabba's palace ship.
Okay, so that's just 29 seconds of something that goes on for, what, 8 minutes? Is that right?
Oh, God. It was such a... They did not yell cut. All I was supposed to do was talk for 10 seconds, and they all said, don't yell cut. See how long he goes. The directors and the writers. And so Parks and Rec is one of my favorite shows ever. It's one of my favorite shows. And I so didn't want to embarrass myself or get fired or whatever. I didn't hear a cut, so I just went going. And apparently the classic fight or flight response?
Yes.
Apparently I have a third response, which is trivia dump, because I just dumped every bit of nerd information in my head. And here's how brilliant Amy Poehler is. If you watch the whole 8-minute clip, she first she does that thing where she's trying to interject because she sees how crazy this is going to be. Then she starts to get into it a little bit when I say that Leia is having an affair with Lando. She goes, no, wait a minute. Like, she's like, no. And then she says this great line, which is, the female character is a little underdeveloped, which so nails that whole comic book sci-fi world. And when Entertainment Weekly did a poster of that pitch, they made a poster with every element of that pitch into it as if it was going to come out. That was the tagline. Amy's brilliant riff tagline. She's such a genius.
Well, Patton Oswalt, of course, is the actor and comedian who can do an 8-minute-long trivia brain dump. All they have to say is action. He's also executive producer of I'll Be Gone in the Dark, a 6-part HBO docuseries that premieres this Sunday, June 28th. Patton, this has been such a pleasure to talk with you. Wow. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. From one parent to another during the pandemic, stay strong.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.